let me know. And if it is just to interview different people that have served in the military,
yes,
and their perspective of the time that they served and what they believe they got accomplished or whatever, you know, I think the perspective that I bring to this whole scenario that is a little bit different is that I was there during a war. I was a product of that war.
Yes.
And then brought to the United States and then chose to serve the country that...
And that's what I would like to get from you.
You bet. That perspective that you're not going to find that many people with with that perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you hearing us? Okay. And now, do you have any input into this? What we're going to try and get accomplished with Tommy?
No, I like it.
Yeah, I think just us talking like this, and then you got stuff that you can edit and put into wherever you want to put it into.
And if you would happen to have something come into your mind that you'd like to ask, don't hesitate. Ask him.
Write you a note?
No, you ask him.
Yeah, just fire away and we can communicate and, yeah.
Well, why don't we just start? I mean, that's the best thing I know of.
Yeah, I think we've started.
We're here. Let's go.
Yeah.
See, and, your phone's working?
Yeah.
You want to put your headphones on?
I don't need headphones on.
We're not on the phone, so you two can just talk to each other.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, that's how much I know about this. I only spent 9 years working here.
Is that where you're going to sit?
Yeah, I'm going to sit right here.
Okay.
Are you going to move any?
Sir?
Are you going to move any like you've been doing?
Yeah, probably. Okay. I'm going to be doing like you.
That's right.
How's
but
the
head's going to be right here in front of the mic, though. I can move, but I can. I know where the money's at right there, you see. I know that. Yeah.
Are you on?
Yeah,
you got us. You got us.
I think
good volumes? Okay.
Good.
Well, we're here with Tommy Webb from Sublette, Kansas. Tommy was in the Marine Corps in what years?
1970 to 1974.
Okay. And we're interviewing veterans and trying to get different perspectives on their time in the military, why they went, and their feelings for the country and different things like that. But I'd like for you to just kind of start and kind of start with your story. Kind of, you were born, you don't know for sure when, but you were born at the time that the Korean War was still going on or it was over?
I was born sometime in 1951, 1952, or 1953. Now, when I speak to groups, I say, ladies, that's what you call long labor.
Uh-huh.
I really don't know when I was born. When I was taken to the orphanage there in Seoul, Korea, in 1958, when I got to the orphanage, the doctor looked at my teeth and gave me a birth year. And then they gave me a calendar, and I got to pick out a month and a date, and that became my birthday. And so, therefore, I really don't know when I was born. It was a guesstimate by the doctor.
Okay. Now, you said when you went to the orphanage, take us back a little bit, Tommy, if you will, to prior to you going into the orphanage. And then I know your story, but I would like to have your story down so we can, when we put this out over the air, people understand where you came from and where you are today.
I was born in a small village. As far as I know, I was born in a little village called Miadi Myeongdong, which was in the 1950s about 10 miles north of Seoul, Korea. And the little village that I lived in was basically women and children. And there was a United Nations Marine base at the base of the hill. My mother was an alcoholic and a prostitute. The 7 years that I lived with my mother, I really cannot remember her being sober. And so I was basically a street child that I raised myself. And when I was about 6 or 7 years of age, I left that village and started traveling south and came to Seoul, Korea. Spent 3 days in a train station because it provided shelter from the cold because this was November and it was cold. And also provided food because when there's people traveling, they would have food with them. And so I would steal the food from the people there at the train station that weren't paying that close attention to their sack of food. And after 3 days, I ran into a police officer, and he put me on a bench. And an hour later, this little white-haired lady came and sat next to me and gave me a piece of candy. And after I finished eating the candy, the police officer said to me, "Do you want to go with her or do you want to go with me?" I wasn't stupid, so I said, "I'll go with her." And she took me to the Holt Orphanage. And there I stayed for 6 months and then was adopted into the United States in June of 1959 at the age of 7 or 8 years of age, which I feel very fortunate because most people were not adopting children that were that old. Most of the children being adopted from Korea were just babies. And when I came to the United States, I was probably the oldest child on that plane of all the children that were being adopted. So I feel very blessed and fortunate to have been adopted at that age.
And so then you were brought to the United States, and the people that adopted you, or he was a minister, as I remember. Is that correct?
The people that adopted me were both educators.
Okay, I'm sorry.
My father was an administrator and school teacher in Oklahoma, and my mother was a school teacher. And my father flew from Oklahoma to Portland to pick me up. And he had served in World War II as a crew chief on B-17s, and had actually been wounded, had actually a propeller of a B-17 had caught him in the back, spun him around and threw him on the ground and just tore his whole back just wide open. And they didn't ever think that he would survive, but he did. And I think that was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they got the call saying that I was coming to the United States and I'd be in Portland in 3 days, and if they wanted to adopt me, someone would have to be there to pick me up. And my parents were a little taken back because usually it took 2 years to adopt a child out of Korea in those days, and they'd only placed their application about 6 months prior to that time. And so they questioned how they were able to get a child so quickly. And they said, "All we can tell you is that this little boy will be in Portland in 3 days if you want him. Someone needs to be there to pick him up." And my father, who really wasn't supposed to fly because of all the damage to his back that had occurred during World War II, said, "I will fly there and pick him up." Yeah.
And so when you got there, he picked you up.
Well, he actually, one of the ladies took me down the steps of the airplane. Mm-hmm. Those were the days when we still had the steps.
Right.
We came down from the plane.
I understand.
And about halfway down, she looked at me. She said, "In-soo, that's my Korean name, Park In-soo." And she said to me, "This is your new Abuji," which is means father in Korean. And I looked down at this man who was Roy Webb. And there's three things that I remember about Roy Webb. One, he had no hair, and I was amazed that this man would be my father who had no hair. And the second thing was that he was a big man because he stood over 6 foot tall and weighed probably about 220, 230 pounds. And the third thing that I remember about Roy Webb was that he had lots of money. And the reason I knew that, he stood there with a suit and a tie on, and when he saw me, the first thing he did was he took me to the restaurant there at the airport, because 7 years of age and 6 months in the orphanage, I weighed all of 39 pounds. And so he took me to the restaurant to try to get me to eat some food.
And as I remember your story, you got to the restaurant and you did eat.
Well, it was difficult because he knew no Korean.
Yes.
And so it's difficult to communicate when... And the only English words I knew was cowboys and Indians and Jesus loves me. It's pretty hard to communicate when that's all the English and he knew no Korean. Well, I did know some other English words.
Yeah, we can't say that.
Yeah, but they told me at the orphanage, "Don't you dare say those words or you're going to be in big time trouble. Those are the words I learned from the Marines. And so here was my dad and I in this restaurant trying to carry on a conversation, not doing very well, when all of a sudden this waitress walked past our table with a platter full of hamburger and french fries that someone else in the restaurant had ordered. And when I smelled those hamburger and french fries, oh, they smelled so good. My stomach just did a flip-flop. And I just pointed at the waitress and the platter of hamburger and french fries. And when I pointed, the waitress stopped and took a plate of hamburger and french fries and put it in front of me for me to eat. And I said to myself, I love this country. All you have to do is point and they bring the food to you. This is wonderful. So when waitresses would go past our table, I'd point and they put another plate in front of me. And Dad said I must have had four or five plates in front of me, and I ate until I was stuffed. I could not eat another bite. And when I could not eat another bite, I was so stuffed, I stood up, and I took a handful of french fries, and I started putting them into my pocket. Because the number one rule of survival on the streets is you never leave food behind. And when my father saw me doing that, he was so embarrassed because the waitresses were all standing around watching this little boy just consume all of this food. And so they came running over and had these bags. And they started putting food into these bags. And then I realized this is how they carried their extra food in this country. And so I took the french fries out of my pockets and put it into one of the bags because I thought if I could do that, then I could hold on to that bag and that'd be my food. And there must have been seven or eight of those doggy bags stuffed full of food. And my father pointed to all of them saying that all that food was mine. And so I just grabbed all of the sacks in my arms, and it was difficult for me to pick it up. And Dad said, I struggled, but he said, I would not let go of that food. And I walked down that airport to the taxi cab, struggling with the food in my arms, but I would not let go of that food.
And the probably you didn't have any belongings or anything really that you brought with you. You didn't have any clothes or suitcase, nothing like that. So the bags of food was probably the only thing you really had at that point in your life.
I had a little flight bag that they had a few things in there, but my father was carrying that. The food is more important to me than that little flight bag was.
And so then he took you to Tulsa?
Well, actually, that evening we went to a motel.
Uh-huh, okay.
And he said when we got to the motel, he opened the door, and I stepped in, and then I looked around the motel room, and he said, I carried all the food over by the bed, the corner of the room, and I put the food down, and then I took my jacket off and covered that food, trying to hide that food the best that I could hide it, not knowing that it's just Dad and I that would be sleeping in that room that night. And I was trying to protect my food the best that I could.
Yeah.
I could protect it. And then the next morning, we flew to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And there I met my mother, Ruth Webb, for the first time. Very unique woman. When she was happy, she was crying. When she was sad, she was crying. But all the tears are just flowing. I mean, she was just boo-hooing. And she hugged me. She kissed me. She looked at my little fingers, make sure that they were all there. And when she got me home, and home was a little town called Weleka, Oklahoma. And she put me in the bathtub, and she was washing me. And as she was washing me, the tears were just flowing. And she put the wash rag down, and she started counting my ribs, which were protruding out. And she prayed this prayer, Lord, put some meat on these bones. And I think God has answered that prayer sufficiently.
You haven't prayed that it stop?
I think my wife has. But
And you were then in Tulsa for how long? You went to school in Tulsa.
Went to Weleka, Oklahoma. Went to a little country school called Graham.
Okay.
Which were predominantly Indians who attended that school. And then in 1961, my parents moved to Junction City, Kansas, and became teachers there. And I grew up in Junction City.
And is that where you graduated from high school?
Well, actually, my graduating class was 1971.
Okay.
And I left high school in 1970 to go on to college.
And where was college?
College was, at that time, Mid-America Nazarene University in Olathe, Kansas. So I never graduated from Junction City. Took my GED, and then my mother said that's not sufficient. And so when I was in the Marine Corps, I took a night class and got my American government credit, which was the only one that I lacked from high school. And so actually my high school graduation is from Iwakuni, Japan in 1973. So born in Korea, educated in the United States, and had my high school diploma from Iwakuni, Japan. Now, a few years ago, I was in Junction City speaking in May, and Junction City, they have a banquet for all the educators and staff at the end of the school year. And I was asked to come and be the speaker at that banquet. After the banquet, the superintendent of schools, the president of the Board of Education, and the principal asked if I would come back on the stage. And at that time, they presented me with an honorary diploma, high school diploma, from Junction City. And so therefore, now I can say that I have a diploma, high school diploma, from Junction City. Yes.
Now, in high school, you played football?
Played football. Played basketball in junior high, but then I never got taller after my freshman year, and so I wrestled for 2 years in high school. Yeah.
And then you went into the Marine Corps when?
I went to the Marine Corps in November of 1970.
And you hadn't graduated from high school?
No, and since I had not completed a semester of college, I was considered a high school dropout.
Okay.
Because I had no college hours, did not have a high school diploma. And so when I went into the Marine Corps, I took my GED. And my mother told me that that wasn't sufficient. So I went to the night class when I went overseas and got my high school diploma from Japan.
What prompted you? What made you go into the Marine Corps at that point in time? Were you bored with school? Were you unhappy in your situation and just wanted some new horizons? Or
the Korean or the Vietnam conflict was getting pretty hot at that point. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with my friends that were going into the service to fight, and I was staying home. And I thought about the men and women who had come to Korea. And because of them, I had the privilege of living in this country. And I thought, you know what? I owe it to them to serve my country as they served and gave me the opportunity to live where I live today. And so I told my parents I was going to leave college and joined the service, and they were not very happy about about that decision. When I told my parents that I was going to join the Marine Corps, mother said, why don't you join the Army or the Air Force? I said, Mom, I remember the Marines, and because of them, I'm here. And really, in reality, it's because of all the men and women in all the services. But as a child, I remember the Marines that were there in my village. And so that was where I wanted to serve. So she wanted me to join for 2 years. I wanted to join for four, and we compromised with three. And then I extended for another 6 months.
But you felt some allegiance to the military as such, the Marine Corps, for coming and fighting in Korea and making South Korea freedom country, a country of freedoms. And when it came time to go to the military, you felt some allegiance to the to our military for giving you the opportunity to come to the United States, get an education, grow up in a free country, and you wanted to pursue that.
You know, if it was not for the men and women who came to fight during the Korean conflict,
mm-hmm.
reality is I probably wouldn't be alive today.
Yes.
And so a large part of who I am and where I am is because of the men and women who served. And we lost over 50,000 Americans during the Korean conflict. And I owe a debt to those men and women to the day that I die.
So now when you were in Japan, Vietnam was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go to Vietnam?
I did not. I was in a part of the military where I had a pretty high clearance.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore did not see combat duty during the 3.5 years that I served in the Marine Corps.
What was your MOS?
It was in communications.
Okay.
But worked in intelligence communications when I was in overseas.
Mm-hmm. And then when you got out of the Marine Corps, you went back to college.
I went to Wichita State University.
Okay.
For 2 years, and then went back to Mid-America University there in Olathe, and then went to seminary for a year. And then I got my master's of clinical therapy, specializing in marriage and family, out of Fringe University. So most of my education has been here in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
I did a master's program in administration in Florida for 2 years, but never completed that master's program.
And so where did you go after you got your degrees? You didn't go immediately to Sublette, did you?
Oh, no. I went to Ohio.
Okay.
As associate pastor there, and then went to Cody, Wyoming, and pastored there. And that was a wonderful, wonderful time. And then went to Sublette to pastor the church there in Sublette. And I was going to leave there in 1988. Because my goal was to get a doctorate, and I knew that staying in Western Kansas, that would never happen, not then. Now, today, there's that availability
right.
Through the internet and such. But back then, that just wasn't a viable option for us. And when I was having lunch at Rotary one day, our county attorney was sitting across from me and said, "Why don't you stay here and run for the district magistrate judge position instead of moving away?" And I said, "Ken," I said, I want to further my education, and I just won't be able to do that if I stay here in Southwest Kansas. And so I'm going to move on. And he looked at me and said, "You know, those messages that you preached about the importance of children and families, I guess you didn't really mean that, did you?" And I looked at Ken, and I said, "Ken, give me a break." He said, "Seriously, if you stay here and run for the district magistrate judge position, not only will you make an impact within our community, but I truly believe that you will make an impact in the lives of Kansans, for the state of Kansas. And so something I would really like for you to think about." And I asked him previously, I said, "Well, I'm not an attorney." And to which he said, "You don't have to be an attorney to be a district magistrate judge. But there is a test of competency that's put out by the Supreme Court that one has to pass
mm-hmm.
to be in that position." So after Rotary that day, we went to his office and looked at some of the statutes. And I researched it a little bit and talked to some of the people in our community. And here I am,
he
25
kind of
years later.
Played dirty pool, didn't he?
Well,
put the B back on you.
He did.
Yeah. Yeah. But as I understand, you have done lots for young people through that position. You've helped a lot of young people.
I want to think that I have.
Yes.
I think with my past, I think I've brought a perspective to the bench that is unique. And I think it has been something that has improved the lives of young people in Southwest Kansas.
I remember you telling a story one time when I was listening to you about how there were some young people there and something, and I don't remember the story exactly, but anyhow, at the end of this, the young man said, "I'll see you tomorrow," and it would have been in court. Is that, do you remember telling that story?
What happened is I was doing all the juvenile cases in Seward County.
Yes.
I live in Haskell County.
Right.
But our judicial district has six counties in Southwest Kansas, the 26th Judicial District. And at that time, I was doing all the juvenile cases in Seward County, which is liberal Kansas. Mm-hmm. And I had, the docket had grown so large that we had to split our what we call children need of care cases from the juvenile offender cases. And I started doing all of the juvenile cases, juvenile offender, children that are less than 18 years of age and more than 10 years of age that have committed or broken laws. And another judge was doing all the abuse and neglect cases at that time. And so when I was doing the juvenile offender cases, I came to realization that, let me back up, because I had left the juvenile docket for about 2 years. Another judge was doing that, but that docket had grown so much that we had decided that we were going to have two judges. And I wanted to do the sink cases, but she said, no, I want to do the sink cases. So I ended up doing the juvenile offender cases there in Seward County. When I started doing the juvenile offender cases, I realized that over 70% of the middle school children that were coming to court were from South Middle School versus West Middle School. There's two middle schools in liberal Kansas. And when I came to that realization that a majority of my kids in middle school were coming from South Middle School, I contacted the principal at that time, and his name was Lance Stout. He grew up in Sublette, and I knew Lance. And I called Lance, and I said, "Lance, I'm doing the juvenile offenders here in Seward County, and I realized that 70% of the kids I see in middle school come from your school." And he said, "Judge, that doesn't surprise me at all." And so I said, "If you will let me, I would like to come and have lunch with you. Pick out 10 of your toughest kids, and I would like to have lunch with them just to visit with them and so they get to know me instead of just from the court, from a different perspective." And he said, "Judge," he said, "you tell us what day and we'll set it up." And so we found a date, and I went to South Middle School, and I got there a little early, and they had already brought the pizza, and so you can smell the pizza in this room, and I'm standing there at the door as a young people. Now, these are 7th and 8th graders as they came into that room, and they knew that I was a judge there. And I want to shake hands with every young person that came in that room. And as I shook their hands, I was amazed how limp the handshakes were, like, yeah, yeah, a sense of indifference. Where's the food was their attitude. So we sat and had lunch together. And then after lunch, I got up and I shared with them a little bit of my story, where I came from. And then I threw it out for questions and answers. And I got questions such as, if my cousin steals a car here in liberal Kansas and he's caught in New Mexico, then what can be done? I mean, those are the kind of questions. If my father beats my mother up and she calls the police, what? And that was the caliber of questions that was being asked of me from these young people that were in that room that day for lunch. And I was answering the questions, and all of a sudden I looked at my watch, and I'd lagged about an hour and a half, and I'd been there almost 2 hours. And I said, "Young people, thank you for coming, but I've got to get back to work. But Before I leave, I would like to shake your hands, just to say thank you for being here, having lunch with me. And I went around and shook the hands of those young people. And what amazed me was how they grabbed my hand and gripped my hand and shook my hand, the difference of the handshake of each and every one of those kids from when I had shook their hand 2 hours previously. And as I shook their hands, they looked up at me and said, thank you, or I'm glad you came. As I got to about the eighth or ninth young person, I shook his hand and he gripped my hand and he looked up and said, Judge, I'll see you Tuesday, which was the juvenile docket. And I looked down, I said, Jose, okay, I'll see you Tuesday in court. And then I left. What amazed me was the difference of the handshakes of those young people in that two-hour period, and I just could not get away from that. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, I woke up about 3 or 3:30 in the morning and thinking about that, and I thought, you know what? I can do this more than just once a year. And I got out of bed and went to the kitchen table, and I thought, if I'm going to do this, what would I call it? And how many kids do I want to try to touch during this time? And so I had different thoughts, and then all of a sudden it came to me, I'm going to call it the lunch program. And the lunch program is going to reflect, I'm there to listen. We're there to understand each other. I want to nurture a relationship with you. I'm here because I care. And the H stood for, as a judge, I want you to know that I'm here to help you, not to hurt you. And I thought if I could get that message of lunch into the hearts and minds of these young children, then there'd be a sense of hope for them, not just for today, but for tomorrow. And I was so excited, and I wanted to call Lance right away, but I didn't want to call him before 7 o'clock in the morning. And so about 7 or 7:15, I called him at his house, and I said, Lance, I said, I've been up half the night, and I've been thinking about the difference of the handshakes and the effect it had on the kids. The old judge, those kids are still talking about the lunch that they had with you to the fellow students. And so we visited a little bit, and I said, Lance, I would like to come at least once a month and have lunch with 10 of your toughest kids there. You pick out the 10. And originally what I told him was I would like to have 10 for 4 months, and then the next semester let those eighth graders be mentors for 8 or 10 seventh graders that would come in for lunch. And I would have all 20 of them for then for the next 4 months for 4 lunches. And he said to me, he said, oh, Judge, he said, there's so many kids that would benefit from having lunch with you. Do you mind if we just have 10 different kids every month so we have more contact? You have more contact with the kids in our school. And do you mind if I bring some of the teachers in during that session so they can hear your story and hopefully be motivated by what they hear? And I said, oh, Lance, it's your school, your kids. I just want to be there to help you and serve you however I can. You let me know how you want to set it up. And so we started the lunch program. We did that for 3 years, and after 3 years, I asked one of my clerks, Donna, to look at the kids that are coming in from South Middle School and West Middle School into our court system, and it was 50% and 50%. And really nothing had changed except that I'd gone there and had lunch with those kids now for nearly 3 years. Yeah. So we can make a difference. And it was only an hour and a half a month that I spent in the life of those kids, and yet it was making a difference.
It's a matter of giving a little of your time.
Yes.
And, you know, what's that worth? Who knows? It got to have a big impact.
Yes.
As far as dollars and cents, probably insignificant what you made during that time, but what you did to help those young people, you can't measure in dollars and cents.
Yeah.
Now, your time in the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
what do you hold most dear to having served not only in the Marine Corps, but having served in this, in our military. You know, veterans are veterans, and we are a group of our own. And anymore, there's so many people that don't have to go that the percentage of young people that come out of high school that do go into the military is a lot less than it was back when you and I were young.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, having served your country in the service, in the mm-hmm. Marine Corps, you have something that really hits you at your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that? Can you tell me what that is?
What I left the Marine Corps, as I look back and reflect upon my 3.5 years in the Marine Corps, the words that come to my mind are words such as commitment. You commit not only to your men, but you commit to a cause. Character. Once you've been given assignment, you do everything within your power to complete that to the best of your ability. When you give your word, there's honor, and not only honor of your name, but the name of the Corps
mm-hmm.
that you uphold. Men and women of character, of integrity. Discipline was something that I learned growing up in my family, but not to the extent that I learned when I went into the Marine Corps. And I value that to this day. I think that's something that is lacking within our culture today. The aspect of commitment to a cause, the discipline of our time, the discipline of our finances, the discipline of our relationships. So I feel very honored that as I reflect back on my time in the Marine Corps, it has helped to mold me to be the person that I am today. It made me better.
Mm-hmm.
People say, you know, the years that you lived in the streets, why is it that you have such a positive attitude? Most people would be very bitter and angry because of the hurts that occurred in your life, the sense of abandonment. I truly believe that we learn from our past. And what we learn will help us become better people in the future. If we accept, and here again, it is something that my parents taught me when I came to the United States, and that is that God's in control. And so the person that I am is because of my faith. And I wish more people had that.
Yes. Now, you went through school and you got
yes.
Into the ministry.
Yes.
And you still are pastoring a small church today? You were the last time I talked to you. Are you still pastoring a small church?
I started as an interim preacher in 1992, August of 1992, and I am still the interim preacher at that little church. So I guess you could say it's a new definition of interim.
Yeah.
But that is my title at that little church. And I've asked the people year after year, please look for a minister. You need someone, because congregation is getting older, just like as I'm getting older. And really, in a few years, we're going to be going in a different direction, Judy and I. And so they need to be looking, and they've chosen not to. But I have felt privileged in having that opportunity mm-hmm. to minister to that small congregation.
Now, you have family.
Yes.
Your wife, Judy.
Yes.
And then you have children.
I have two children, one Angel and one Other. and 7 grandchildren. And so we feel very blessed in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And have you, do they, I'm sure they know of your history, of your story. And
yes.
And you went back to Korea in 73, you said? No.
I took an R&R in 1973.
Okay.
Most of the people were taking R&R different places. When I told them I wanted to go to Korea for my R&R, mm-hmm. they sort of scratched their head and said, Sergeant, why do you want to go to Korea? And so I explained to them, that I said, we understand. And so they got range of flights and everything. And actually, it took me most of the day to fly in on that Friday. Got in late Friday night. I only had Saturday because then I had to get to the base on Sunday to fly back.
Mm-hmm.
So only spent one day there in Korea. And that's the only opportunity that I've ever had to go back to
Korea.
Lots
of changes from that period of time?
Oh, my. The changes from 1958 that I remember as a child to what I saw in 1973 was night and day.
Right.
Just unreal.
Mm-hmm.
How the city had grown and how modern everything had become in that time span.
Now, do you kind of follow the current situation in Korea now? Do you has that got any place of importance in the way you see things going on, or is it just kind of like what goes on in the world today?
I follow what's going on in North Korea, just like I follow how things are going in Iran, uh-huh. in the Middle East,
okay.
Because of world situation. I have so many irons in the fire in my life right
mm-hmm,
now
mm-hmm.
with traveling and speaking throughout the United States and pastoring this little church and judging. And I have a master's degree in clinical therapy, so I might see a family once or twice a year that I might do a little bit of therapy with. But the time just isn't there. But when I retire, one of the things that I want to do is to study more of the Korean culture, their art, their history, because that is my mother's country. And so therefore, it is part of my history,
that's your
my
heritage.
That's
yeah.
right. That's and heritage. So, and then travel there and to spend some time there in Korea. That's one of my things on my bucket list.
Yeah. Now, I know you do speaking engagements.
Yes.
And is that picking up, staying static? Is it getting demanding more and more of your time? Or do you have room for another speaking engagement?
Oh, I'm always open for more, and that is really where my heart is, to share my life story. And, you know, when you're talking about interviewing military people,
mm-hmm.
I love to speak to military groups, just as I do to high schools or educators. But I remember I spoke at a national conference in Denver, Colorado, to military who had come from all over the United States for this conference. And I spoke for about 2 hours, and we took a break after the first hour. And there must have been 20 to 30 military personnel that came up to the platform before I was able to leave the platform just to shake my hand and say something to me. And one of the ladies that came up to me said, thank you for giving me hope. I had come here to Denver with the determination that I would never leave here. And then she turned around and walked away. And there are other people in line, so I was not able to continue it, and she just walked away. But that haunted me. And the following week, I contacted the person that had brought me into the conference from Washington, D.C., and I just asked him if he'd be willing to give me the emails of all the people that were at that conference, hoping that I might be able to pick up a name and try to contact this individual. And, And the person that I was talking to in Washington, D.C. said, oh, Judge, we'll do that for you. And if nothing else, I was going to just email everyone and say, hey, with the person that came up and talked to me between the two sessions, would you email me and just let me know how things are going? Somehow I'd make contact with this individual. And the next day, before I had a chance to send out an email to all the participants of that conference, I got an email from a woman from eastern part of the United States saying, I was that individual that came up to you. And she said, I came back from overseas duty for a year and came home to situations that with my daughter and marriage, and things were just going south. To the point that I was so depressed that when I went to the conference in Denver, I'd already planned to take my life. I was never going to leave Denver and come back to this situation. But she said, when you shared your life story and I heard your story, she said, things took a different perspective. And I had the determination to not quit. You didn't quit. And so therefore, I'm not going to quit. And you gave me hope. She said, thank you. And so those are things that motivate me, touching lives. And I could tell you story after story. My wife and I just spent a week in Maine, and we had the opportunity to speak to students in 18 different high schools. We had 6 different assemblies in 3 days, and some schools bus their students in for over an hour and a half to get to that assembly. But the emails and the letters that I received from those students thanking me and what a difference that assembly had made in their life. And so that is something that I want to really do as long as I can, to make a difference in the lives of those that I have the opportunity to share my story with.
Well, I've come to know you over the years, and I've heard you several times. And I always enjoy being able to sit down and visit with you and listen to the stories that you share after we last were together, the mm-hmm. things that have happened. And it's just amazing to me the things that do happen that you cause and the hope that you give people. I wish I could do that more often, and I suppose part of that is maybe because I don't take the time to do it, but it's amazing what you do accomplish. And
thank you.
You know, the pay you're getting for doing this today is, if you'll, I think we could share how folks might be able to get a hold of you if they ever wanted to see about you coming and speaking to their group or their class or anything. And they would a hold of you through over your website. You have a website?
My website is www.judgeweb.org.
Okay.
And they can contact me through that.
Yeah.
And I'd love to visit with them. Yes. Yeah.